Welcome to the Open Apple Podcast, where we celebrate the Apple II. Whether you're a longtime user, a nostalgic visitor, or a newcomer to the community, join us as we share news and memories of Steve Wozniak's most famous personal computer.
Hello and welcome to Open Apple. This is episode 43 for January 2015. Happy New Year from Quinn and Mike at Open Apple. Speaking of Mike, how are you?
I'm good, Quinn. How was your holidays?
Oh, it was excellent. I spent some time with the fam up in Can-Can, which is Canada for the non-limerickly inclined. And yeah, it was great. It was cold, but lots of fun. And got home in time to do some retro computing stuff, which I'm still working on as we speak. And well, not as we speak. I put down the power saw in order to record the show here. But yeah, otherwise, it's been really great. How about you?
Well, first, before I answer, I did have a question for you, because for as long as I've known you now, you've been threatening that when you get back there, you're going to have to dig your 2GS out of the basement and get your disks and all that. How did that go? Excavation.
Yeah. So I did, in fact, I went up there this time with noble intentions. So for anyone who doesn't know by now, yes, my family is up in Canada where I'm from. And my parents' basement contains all of my Apple II goodies, which they have, like the wonderful parents they are, they've loyally kept clean and dry and stored all these years from house to house. And so there is an Apple II Plus and a Laser 128 and an Apple II GS with many floppy drives and hard drive for the 2GS and lots of other goodies. There's a joystick. I've got a trackball. There's a couple of mice. Lots of fun stuff and reams of floppy disks. And there's just no way, unfortunately, that I can get it all down here where I live in California. So I've been thinking, well, maybe I can at least go up and rescue some of the floppy disks. And sure. So I thought this time I will do that. And unfortunately, I just didn't have any room at all in my luggage. So So I failed in that mission. But occasionally my parents do come to visit me and they like to drive. So the next time they come to visit, I'm scheming to bribe them into loading all that stuff into their truck and bringing it down here. But we'll see.
Well, either that or you can take like a cryoflux card or something like that up there with you and just image the diskettes while you're there.
I could, yeah. That would be tough, actually, just the way that the stuff is pretty buried. But I did do some digging and I just sort of verified that it's all still there, including some of the more critical items like the 2GS monitor, which of course is very important. Yeah, it's all there. The one thing I actually didn't do, which I'm kicking myself for forgetting to do. I wanted to take the cover off the 2GS and just look at that battery.
Oh, yeah. Very important.
And yeah, and honestly, my plan was to just cut it off right now, whether it's, you know, leaking yet or not. Because as we all know, those batteries, there's only two kinds of 2GS batteries, ones that are currently leaking and ones that are imminently going to leak. So I don't
That's
know. Yeah, I don't know which I have yet. I'm scared to crack it open and maybe I'll find a big old mess down there. But luckily, all of the equipment is stored in a cool, dry place, and so it should be, about as well stored as one could hope for, so I'm relatively confident it will all still be there. But yeah, I am looking forward to doing some digital archaeology on all those floppy disks. There's just, you know, years and years of school projects and, you know, learning to program adventures and things stored on all of them that, along with hundreds of pirated games. But, it's the personal stuff that would be fun to go through. So, yeah. So the TLDR is I failed. Maybe next year. So, how about you? What, any Apple II related news in your holiday season?
Well, if you pay attention to the Facebook Apple II enthusiast group, you will see that I posted a picture of a gift that my father actually tracked down for me. It's a die-cast 1/18th scale miniature Porsche 935 K3 dressed up in the Apple-sponsored livery of the 1980 Le Mans 24 Hours race. That was very cool. And I'd seen this before online and thought, gee, that's kind of cool. But there were only 3,000 of them made, and they sold out quickly, and they retailed at like $170. So it wasn't something that I was going to buy for myself. And he managed to track one down for less than that. And when I got it, obviously, having something in front of you is a lot cooler than just the pictures. And there's certainly, when you get it, you open it up and get to play with it a little bit. Yeah, it was really neat. I was very impressed. So thank you, Dad.
Yeah, I have to say, the pictures of that thing, as of course a retro Apple fan and a racing fan, the pictures of that thing melted my brain. It is amazing. I had no idea that Apple ever sponsored a race car. So yeah, to see a race car all covered in the stripy Apple logos was just, yeah, I was blown away by that. I had no idea.
So here's the thing about that, and it would make sense because it was made by TruScale, which is a company that makes these, you know, miniature diecast models for collectors, that they would market it to the collectors of miniatures. Because if you read through that thread, you can see that, you know, some people obviously knew what this was, but a lot of Apple II fans had no idea that they had done this. And so I imagine most of those 3,000 mini Porsches ended up in collectors' hands. Now, it's actually not a bad thing, because I think a lot of dealers and brokers bought them, like 20 of them. And because you can find them pretty easily on eBay for, you know, $100 to $120. So if you really want one, they're out there. They're not hard to get a hold of, even brand new unwrapped. It's a little pricey, but for the Apple II fan who has everything, as far as the actual Porsche itself, so Steve Jobs is known, you know, later in life as having been a fan of that, of Mercedes, and he had that 55 SL or whatever it was. He drove without plates and would park in handicapped spots all over the place. But earlier in his life and career, he was a fan of Porsche. And, in fact, when the Mac came out and he was trying to motivate the sales team, that the top sales people would get, I think it was that he gave away 944s or something like that. So he does have the history with the Porsche. And when this car debuted in 1980, at the Sebring 12 hours, Jobs was there. And I'm not sure how this sort of slipped through the cracks, other than it has nothing to do with computers, other than that they sponsored this thing. For those who don't know, they keep track of these cars in the history of the supercars, the racing cars, by the chassis serial number, because, you know, they get banged up and parts get replaced and new sponsorship comes on and it gets repainted and things like that. So this actual chassis as an Apple car raced several times in 1980, and then it was repainted as a Red Roof Inn or something like that. Became several other things before in its life. So there are some videos out there online of an Apple 935 K3, which apparently, so in Europe right now, I guess there's one of these, there's this car that looks like one, but I guess it's not. It's a copy. It's a tube car with the livery painted on. But other than that, and an original, it does have a 935 K3 engine in it, but it's not the same car. But it's still kind of cool to, if you want to see, I guess, what it looked like and things. The videos are there, and it's fun to take a little diversion down this weird side path of Apple history.
Yeah, we'll try and link to some of those videos maybe in the show notes, because it is fun to see that. Yeah, that's quite a popular thing to do, actually, with vintage racing, is to sort of pick a popular or an interesting livery from the time and recreate it. So yeah, you can at least get the gist of what it looked like. In fact, my own racing team, we've got a Lotus that we have run in both the John Player Special livery, and we're currently running it in the Gold Leaf Lotus livery for that reason. So, and you know, a lot of BMW racers use some of the, you know, classic Andy Warhol livery and other M Division liveries that they used. So, yeah, it's that thing is really, really cool. So, and as you say, it's probably, if not now, soon will be available, probably relatively inexpensively, because most of them are probably going to, you know, Porsche collectors who are notorious for wanting to have every version of every particular model of every livery of every car. So, yeah, you know, Porsche diecast collectors are famous for having walls and walls of apparently identical looking 911s and 944s and 935s. So somewhere out there, there's probably one of those who doesn't even care about retro computers, but would let it go for a reasonable price. So, yeah. So, well, that's very cool, though.
The thing is, I guess the one in Europe isn't, I don't know if it's been banned from the tracks, but there's a couple of blogs out there that both kind of make a sort of hazy mention of the fact that A, this is a copy, and B, the guy that owns it is not telling people that it's a copy. I don't know if he's actively lying about it. That wasn't the impression I got. It was more like, well, he's okay if you believe this is the original car. And I think the tracks and the rules over there are pretty stringent about that sort of thing. And so I don't know if he got himself banned because they found out that he was not telling the truth or what the deal is, but I guess it hasn't been racing there as recently, but the videos are still up, and it's certainly a rush, because a couple of them are like dashboard cams of other cars chasing this car around the track. And so you get to actually see it in action. It's a lot of fun to watch, actually.
Yeah. I wonder what the story is there. I mean, if he's campaigning it in vintage racing, he certainly wouldn't even make it through tech inspection. I mean, they would have, yeah, certainly caught that instantly. So, yeah, I wonder what the story is there. Usually, getting banned from races is frequently political as much as anything. Maybe he took the wrong people out to dinner or something. Who knows? So, yeah, so moving along, I guess I wanted to, before we move into some of our normal segments, we've got a really cool interview coming up and lots of news to talk about. I wanted to give a quick shout out to Sean Vahey at A2 Central.
I've heard of that site.
Haven't we all? yeah, to me, it's just hands down the number one Apple II news site. And it's certainly bookmarked in my browser, and I go there regularly. He had expressed recently on Facebook that he was the site was taking a lot of time and a lot of energy, and he wasn't sure if people still appreciated it or not. And I hope that he knows that we do. I certainly do. So if any of you are wondering where to go for Apple II news, you should go to a2central.com. And we've linked to that indirectly for lots of stories here on the show, and I'll link to it again right here just for that reason.
So in 2011, maybe, I'm not great with dates. Basically, Sean asked me if I would take over as sort of the lead technical editor for A2 Central to post all the stories and stuff. And he would still manage the back end of the site and take care of, the CMS and things like that. But, and I agreed, and I made it for, I think, a year, maybe a little bit longer. And man, it is a lot of work keeping that thing updated and keeping track of the stories. And of course, when you're doing that, you're competing with Bill Martins over at Call Apple. Hi, Bill. So you want to get the stories up first. And it's, it's tough. And so, yeah, definitely, Sean, my hat's off to you for hanging on as long as you can. We do get a lot of our news tips for the things that we talk about on the show from A2 Central and from Call Apple and other sources. But I think it's a really important resource for the community. And if Sean doesn't want to continue doing it, I hope that he can find somebody who will step up and at least help out and maybe lessen the burden a little bit, because it is a ton of work.
Yeah, definitely. I think anyone who's never run a website maybe doesn't appreciate that. It seems like a simple thing, but I've got my blog, and I update that pretty infrequently, but even that, I'm just amazed. Sometimes it takes an entire Saturday to do one little thing on there. Just things go wrong, and software doesn't cooperate, or the server host doesn't cooperate or whatever. So it is astonishingly time consuming to do. So if anyone out there is interested in volunteering to help out with A2 Central, I'm sure that Sean would definitely appreciate it. And we will link to contact info as well if you are interested.
All right. So I guess that wraps up our little intro, and we'll just kind of roll into our interview here. It's how would you describe him? Is he a maker? Is he a hacker? Probably all of these things.
Yeah.
Ben Heck, who we know from the Apple IIgs that he did and turned into a laptop in 2008. And then more recently, he turned an Apple I into a laptop. He agreed to sit down. He's been making the rounds, so you may have heard some of this on some of the other podcasts before, but I think you'll find that it's still a pretty interesting interview.
Yeah, we had tried to focus on sort of Apple II related content. Ben has reasonable amount of history there, and he's done a number of projects in the area of Apple II related stuff. So we're really excited to have him on the show.
Yeah, very personable and just a fun interview. He's a great talker. So here you go.
Hi, I'm Randy Wigginton, and welcome to the Open Apple Podcast.
Most of our listeners probably, in fact, I know that all of our listeners know who our interview subject is today. I became familiar with him back in, 2008 or so, when he decided to turn a 2GS into a laptop computer. And I know a lot of other people went, who is this Ben Heck person at the same time? So yes, we have Ben Heck with us. Hello, Ben.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm perplexed by this thing. Sorry, I was typing into my calculator. I'm okay.
Welcome to Open Apple.
Thanks. What is Open Apple besides a key on a Macintosh?
Well, we are the number one co-ed hosted Apple II podcast, in fact.
By number one, she means only.
And still number one. Thank you very much. And actually the only Apple II podcast of any description, Carrington Vanston.
Oh.
Sorry, that's an inside joke, Ben. All right. So why don't we roll into some questions here for Mr. Heckendorn. Many of our listeners also know you from your general hacking exploits, myself included. I'm a big fan of your site and your YouTube channel, rather, that you've got with Element 14 going there.
Thanks for watching.
Brought to you by Element 14. So why don't we start with the new stuff, actually, since that's kind of what prompted this conversation initially. Tell us about your Apple One replica project. How did you get the idea to do that?
Last year, I acquired a ZX Spectrum from Ireland. I'm obviously a big 8-bit computer fan. Anyway, we did this ZX Spectrum project over the course of a few months, basically last summer, and that really got me back in the mood for 8-bit computers. So after I completed that, I was like, what computers have I not done anything with yet? And the Apple One was one of them. Also the Amiga and the Atari ST, and I guess the Macintosh. But, you know, I gotta get through them one by one. So the Sinclair Spectrum, I had rewired the entire computer by hand, which was, you know, kind of ridiculous, but also a fun challenge. Like, some people might do crochet or needlepoint or build a ship in the bottle. I like to wire complex circuits by hand. So when I came to the Apple One replica, I'm like, oh, well, this is just a 6502 computer with a strange video circuit. So this is pretty simple. So it was fun to do. And then also, obviously, I'm big in the maker movement and I like to build things. And the Apple One was, of course, a kit, not a full computer. So I wanted to make something that kind of harkened back to that, you know, wooden box era. That's why I went with a wood motif in my design. So that's kind of why I did it. Also because it was cool.
There is sort of a sub-hobby, I guess, of people replicating Apple Ones these days. And I guess it's a target for replication because it's so kind of simple. And yeah. One thing I see a lot of on the internet is these two-chip clones where people try to clone it with, you know, just the CPU and one other support chip. And your design is similar to that, but you made some interesting choices. For example, I like the use of the propeller to kind of do the video and some of the ancillary tasks. What sort of prompted those particular design decisions about which chips to use and so forth?
Well, I was researching and I came across the Replica One, I believe, is one of the kits you can get.
Yes, Vince Briel's kit, Sam.
Yep, and they were using a propeller, and I actually used that microcontroller in my pinball projects as well as other things, so I was very familiar with it. I was like, oh, I know that microcontroller inside and out. This will be easy. And I wrote my own keyboard scanner, so instead of like hooking up a PS2 keyboard, I created a keyboard matrix that would be scanned by the propeller, and then it would send that back. And I still use the, 6532 peripheral interface adapter chip. I use an original one, but I believe I probably could have emulated that with the propeller given more time.
So did you use like a vintage 6502 off of, you know, eBay, or did you use like a modern one from Western Design Center? Or
I bought a vintage one off eBay. By vintage, though, oh gosh, it wasn't that old. I want to say it was like 2002 was the date code. I mean, okay. they still make that stuff.
Yeah.
I think they still make the Z80 too, don't they?
Yeah, I believe they do. Yeah. And the 6502, they still make it. The modern one is, it's still a 6502. It's got a lot of new features. It's got better, you know, power management, and it's almost kind of a microcontroller, but it'll still run 6502 code, and the pinouts, I believe, are still compatible. So that's,
yeah. That company, what, Western?
Western Design Center, yeah.
Right. Yeah, they were the ones who made the, oh gosh, it was in the Apple IIgs, right, where it was the same thing that was in the Super Nintendo?
Yeah.
Right? It had a 16-bit mode as well.
Yeah, the 65C816. Now, the one of the more interesting aspects of your project is the sort of laptop form factor. What prompted you to do that way?
I've built many laptop-style projects in the past. I famously made a laptop out of the Xbox 360. I've done the PlayStation 3. I did something recently with the Xbox One. I'd also done a Commodore 64, two different versions, an Atari 800. Was there something else in there? Oh, Apple IIgs, as you mentioned. You know, so people, when they think of portable computers, they think of laptops. So that's a fun form factor to do. Also, I had these dodgy LCD screens laying around, and I was like, well, I got to use these things up for something. They're like, you know, 8-inch composite screens. And I'm like, oh, an old computer with a crappy terminal output would be perfect for these screens. So part of it was just to use up some LCDs.
Well, so that's interesting, because that actually leads into one of my other questions, which is about the screen. So, you know, a lot of us in the Apple II community are trying to, we're always looking for new display solutions, because of course these old CRTs are dying, and they're also just bulky and awkward and annoying. So LCDs are always desirable, but it's getting harder and harder to find, you know, 4:3 aspect LCDs with composite inputs that will display Apple II content in particular, because the Apple II's output is not exactly NTSC, it's sort of NTSC-ish. And so I guess my question for you is how do you go about sourcing your screens, and what kinds of things do you look for? Do you have any tips for people wanting to, you know, find LCDs for retro computers?
So it's not quite like NTSC. It doesn't have the color chroma subcarrier or the audio. What's different about it?
Well,
I guess that's not really answering your question.
Yeah, so the Apple II's composite is, so it relies on artifact color for number one. It doesn't have proper color. It does have the color burst signal, but it relies on artifact color.
Oh, really? So, all the color is via artifact? And I didn't know that. Yeah, I remember that from the Atari 800 days.
Yeah, so that's why it has all these annoying properties in software where, for example, certain colors can't be on certain pixels and certain colors can't be next to certain other colors and so on. So it was all.
So you would get four colors. You'd get black, white, and then you'd get the odd shift and the even shift, right?
Basically, yeah. And then Woz ended up adding this other sort of high bit trick where you can squeeze two more colors out of it. So it has six colors, but there's two whites and two blacks. And so this, it's all very strange. But it's sort of like six opposing angles in the NTSC signal space, basically. It was all about reducing chip count. So he was able to do all this with a very small number of chips, which is why it's all so weird.
You know, I hadn't realized that there was basically only single bit color on the Apple II. I always assumed it was like 2-bit, like the, you know, other 8-bit computers, but I guess it was older than the Atari and the Commodore. So it's not surprising.
You know, he did some pretty clever things with it. You know, he does manage to get 16 colors out of low res. And in fact, the double high res mode is especially face melting because it does, you know, 16 colors at nearly high res resolutions, but with it just absolutely Byzantine memory structure architecture that's just, it requires a lot of software to work with. But the two modes that are especially difficult for modern LCDs to display are the double high res graphics mode and the 80 column text mode. So those are the two that, you know, we're always really looking for LCDs. So
would those display on a standard Apple II monitor or not?
Yeah, a standard Apple II monitor has no trouble, or sort of any composite monitor from the period. I don't know what it is, but older monitors seem to be, especially CRTs, seem to be a lot more tolerant of some of the oddities of the video signal. So, but modern LCDs are a little fussier, so you tend to get blurring and instability and so on in the picture.
A lot of the I don't know necessarily about the Apple II, but I know the old game consoles, they were only single field. In an NTSC frame, there's, you know, it's interlaced,
right,
and there's two fields, and they would actually only use one of the fields. You know, you'd see a resolution like 256 by 240, whereas NTSC frame, it's like 480 visible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can understand why a modern LCD, I mean, LCDs are kind of, they want a specific input.
Mm-hmm.
So all these tricks that they use to get higher resolutions is probably why you're having trouble mapping it.
Yeah, it's basically down to how good the driver board is for the panel. And the driver boards tend to, at least for composite, either be not very good or just really fussy about the quality of the signal coming in.
So a Apple II composite video to modern VGA connector would be something people would want to buy?
It, very much so.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, the ones that are out there, you can certainly buy composite to VGA converters on eBay and so on, but they almost all don't work with the Apple II. So
I guess you'd have to take a look. Well, you know, we just recently did something like that. We found this weird LCD glass from eBay or China or something, and it's this like 4-to-1 ratio LCD. It's like really wide. And I reverse engineered it to figure out how to get signals to it. That's probably what you'd have to do is you'd have to go through all these. You'd have to put a test pattern on the Apple II and then hook it up to an oscilloscope and basically kind of reverse engineer the signals coming off of it. And then if you could take those signals and put them into an FPGA, then you could remap it for a VGA or HDMI or DVI or some other modern connection.
Mm, that's a good thought. There is one fellow in Japan who has a small company called Nishida Radio, and he produces probably some of the best video converters for the Apple II. And he's got a couple of solutions that were possibly developed with a process like you describe. And his adapters are pretty great, but there's quite a huge demand for them. And he's only, you know, one guy, and he can only make so many. It's a hobby for him. So there's definitely a market for that. So, speaking of this problem, why don't we roll into your 2GS? So we can circle back to your Apple One replica later if we like, and we'll certainly link to that in the show notes so everyone can look at that. The Apple II video is challenging, but what's even more challenging is Apple IIgs video. And in fact, this is probably the number one source of conversation about the IIgs in any forum that you might find. And that's how to replicate that video, because it had that really weird 15 kilohertz refresh, horizontal refresh RGB signal. And it's notoriously difficult to replicate. It's similar actually to arcade monitors. It's basically RGB arcade video.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, that's not that weird.
it's certainly weird in the land of retro computing.
Well, you wouldn't be able to hook that up to a modern VGA monitor because the refresh rate would be too low.
Yeah. So, and again, there are some converters, some of the arcade converter boards do work. But so what's interesting about your 2GS laptop project is that you used an LCD. Can you tell us a little bit about how you made that video circuit work?
Yeah, I believe we just used the composite video output on the Apple IIgs. I mean, apparently it had one. This has been like 6 years ago. I don't remember all the details. Of course, composite and not very good are kind of synonymous.
Yeah, I think so on the 2GS, it's bad enough that it basically renders the 640 by 200 video mode unusable, which is why a lot of people are unsatisfied with it.
That makes sense because, you know, the text would artifact into each other. You know, like an N might become cyan square, for instance. Yeah, I remember it being acceptable, but you're right. You know what would work? It's kind of small, but you know those Sony PlayStation 1 portable monitors they had? I don't know if you've ever come across one of those.
I remember those. Yeah, they, I think they called it the PS1 or something, didn't they?
Yeah, and they had a monitor. That little monitor, I don't know if they're probably harder to find than they used to be because, you know, time has passed. That thing was really awesome. That thing could take 15 kilohertz RGB in, so you could hook it directly up to arcade machines.
Oh, really?
And it probably would also work with Apple IIgs. It's obviously small in size. Huh, okay, so an adapter that would take the 15 kilohertz RGB signal from a 2GS. And see, that would actually be pretty straightforward to make into VGA. You'd basically just have to do a line doubler.
Right, yeah, and that's basically what the arcade adapter boards do, and there are a couple of those that do work with the 2GS. The challenges are basically to get the quality really, really high, because of course the original 2GS monitor just looks beautiful. It's just really, really sharp and nice, and that's of course what most 2GS users are used to. So any substitute, if it isn't that good, then everybody's unhappy. So. And then the other problem is delay, of course, for arcade games. If the adapter introduces any kind of latency into the signal, then it's kind of becomes unusable for some of the faster games.
There's a lot of delay, basically. And well, modern electronics are actually worse because you have HDMI and that gets, you know, converted to your glass. Then you have post-processing going on. So you can have quite a bit of delay. Oh, of course, I'm talking about modern stuff. I was going to say the Apple IIgs. Hold on. I'm reclicking my thoughts. Blah, 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 arcade. Shoot, I completely forgot what I was going to say about the pixels.
It's all right, we'll circle back. Do you have sources that you rely on for LCDs, or you mentioned you have a bunch of them around you're trying to get rid of? Where do you go for that kind of stuff?
Okay, I used to get them from a place called Excel Electronics, which would sell... It was kind of like for high-end car stereo. So they'd build monitors into the cars or, you know, build things into your dashboard. And I really liked them because they had very simple chips. They had PAL NTSC, you know, they had two crystals or some sort of, you know, clock divider to do that. And the prices were reasonable. It's kind of harder to find screens now because that whole small LCD market has been completely gutted by cell phones, which of course have LCD screens, but not really anything that you'd use for a hobbyist standpoint. And it's also kind of tough to make, well, at least from my perspective, make anything portable because who wants a 17-inch LCD when you can get a 20-inch for $200 from Best Buy? So it's portions of the LCD market are kind of becoming extinct, at least in my experience. There's a lot of stuff on eBay. That's where I found my weird widescreen LCDs. But then I tried to reorder them, and I got something completely different. And the resolution on the box wasn't actually what they were. So it's kind of the Wild Wild West. But I've noticed, usually for weird LCDs, eBay's a pretty good solution.
Okay. Yeah, you're exactly right about the LCD, that sort of middle zone of, especially for Apple IIs, you know, people are often looking for something a little smaller. So something in like the 8 to 12 inch range, let's say. And yeah, that, that's a tough range to find 4.3 aspect. And of course, yeah, the other problem is everything's 69 now. So there was this sort of narrow window of time at the end of the 90s where you could still get, you know, 4.3 small LCDs before 16, after CRTs, but before 16.9 took over. So you sort of have to try to find stuff from that sort of 5-year period that also happens to have composite and all the other, you know, various requirements for the Apple II. It's a tough challenge.
If you did an FPGA implementation, you'd probably have like a 1-frame lag or buffer, but you could capture the 15 kilohertz data coming in, and then you could like basically upscale it to fit. And if you had a widescreen monitor, you could basically just letterbox, you know, make the sides black or something.
Sure, yeah. So more on the subject of your 2GS laptop, one of the cool features of it is the built-in compact flash. So is that, did you use like a CFFA 3000 for that? Or it wouldn't have been the 3000 back then, but did you use a CFFA for that or?
Oh, I remember I bought something online. That's all I remembered. It fit into an expansion slot.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, gosh. That was like a million projects ago.
Yeah, we're dredging up ancient history here. So, yeah, it looks like in the pictures that it was probably a CFFA, but I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, and I know I had to wire it sideways to make it fit. And I can't remember if I had that. I have another 2GS in my shop I need to do something with. Well, I should say I have the motherboard and the RAM expansion. But I always thought that was a really neat computer. I played that a lot in high school. It had like that. It had some cool games on it. I know it was kind of, I don't want to say a flop, but wasn't really... Didn't really make a huge dent in the Apple world, but it was a neat little computer.
It's an odd machine. I mean, yeah, the fans of it are extremely devoted, and the non-fans of it haven't heard of it. So it's one of those weird little cult computers.
Was it expensive when it came out? I know that's kind of a silly question with Apple, but...
It was more expensive, I think, than like an Amiga or an Atari ST, and it also came out a little...
It was?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, well, there's your problem.
Yeah, well, and it also came out a little later, and it was a little slower, and if the conspiracy theorists in the community are fond of this theory. So there is a theory that it was intentionally crippled so as not to compete with the Mac, but then that begs the question, why release it at all? But yeah, it's a funny machine with a funny history, and it was kind of the very tail end of the line.
Yeah, because that was like, what, 86, 87?
86.
Okay, so the Amiga and the Apple Atari SD were out at that time. And those were like, what, around $1,100 or $1,200? I'm sure the Atari was like made cheaply.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the Amiga had 68,000 in it, whereas the 2GS had, you know, this kind of barely 16-bit technically on paper CPU running at, you know, a paltry 2.8 megahertz. And so it was pretty crippled in a lot of ways. And it had the 2E compatibility, which forced the bus down to 1 megahertz whenever you're touching video memory or various other systems. So, yeah, the machine had amazing potential, but it had a bit of a boat anchor on it as well, which, you know, these limits could all be worked around with really clever programming, but...
I was playing Super Castlevania 4 a couple months ago on the Super Nintendo, and it had some slowdown. And I remember slowdown was kind of the big joke with the Super Nintendo. So anyway, I was looking at the processor, and I'm like, it only has an 8-bit data bus, even though it's a 16-bit chip. I couldn't believe that. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's sort of Western Design Center's answer to the 68008, you know, when you want those 16-bit instructions, but you don't want to have to run all the extra wires for the address and data bus. It's sort of a way to compromise.
Apple only ran a few print ads for that machine, and most of them didn't even mention the word Apple 2GS in the ad anywhere. It just had a picture of it and what it could do. You know, the 2E had been selling well into the educational market, and we could just sell these 2GSs into that and maybe hold on to that for a little bit longer. And that's why that way it's not competing with the Mac. And because most of the schools that bought it just use them as fast Apple 2Es anyway. So,
right. Yeah.
The 2E, that was the like the flat white one. Is that correct?
No, that's the 2C.
Okay. Which was the like the beige one, like the ubiquitous one?
That would have been the 2E. That was by far the most popular of the two lines.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I graduated high school in 1994, and we were still using them in 1994 in computer class. I remember they were still operational. Of course, back then, I guess more time has passed since that than the computer. Yeah, it was 20 years ago, and at that time, that computer would have only been, what, 17 years old? Mind blown.
The 2E, they sold new at retail up until 1993.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah, the Apple II line had an amazing run. I mean, far longer than any, you know, particular version of the Mac architecture or anything like that. Of course, back then, you know, a change was a little bit slower, so a particular architecture could be useful for a lot longer. But yeah, the Apple II had an amazing run.
It's funny to look back at those computers, like the ZX Spectrum is another interesting one. Like any game you can think of was ported to that, like well into the 90s. It's insane. Like Street Fighter II is ported to the ZX Spectrum.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and you know, as you mentioned, the Apple II was, you know, obviously even older. It was 77, right?
Yeah. And what's amazing is that the architecture remained basically unchanged for that whole period. I mean, you know, they did some tricks to shoehorn another 64K of RAM into it, and they added some, you know, fancier video modes with, again, basic tricks. But yeah, the fundamental architecture of the machine, it was 1977 technology, fundamentally, all the way into the 90s. So it's, you know, all the way into the 90s, there were still games with that wacky six color artifact video and, you know, all the rest of it.
Like Oregon Trail. Wasn't there, I remember on the, so I had an Atari 800 when I was a kid because we would never have been able to afford an Apple. And it didn't have to use artifacting, but it's high resolution mode, which was like 320 by 240. If you put pixels side by side, or I'm sorry, if you gap the pixels, you would get artifacting. And whether or not you're on the even or odd line, you'd get either, I think it was like greenish or cyan. But then I remember, I believe the PAL and versus NTSC, the artifacting would flip. And also, if you had an older version of the machine, it would flip as well. So if the Apple II was using the same kind of artifacting, how do they prevent, like, you know, grass from looking like blood or something? Or was it because they always had the same monitors, so it never changed?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. They did manage to maintain a consistent set of artifact colors throughout the entire line and across different regions. But yeah, I'm not honestly sure the details of how some of that worked.
An artifact color would cut your horizontal resolution, what, effectively half?
Yeah, exactly. So if you wanted to achieve any kind of real colors, that's why, in fact, the double high res mode, your horizontal resolution was 140 as opposed to it was 280 in the normal, quote, high res mode. But that 280 wasn't really 280, because if you wanted to have a solid block of certain colors, you lost half your resolution effectively. So, yeah. It's a funny numbers game. But so ostensibly, the double high res mode is 16 colors on any pixel, but it's only 140 pixels wide. And then there's all the craziness where they literally every other column of pixels is mapped into a different bank of memory. So you literally have to flip memory back and forth to draw a horizontal line. And yeah, it gets crazy real fast. Because of course they didn't have any addressing space for all the extra video memory that was going to be needed.
To be fair, if you had the Commodore 64 or the Atari 800, you know, they actually had colors you could map and change, but it was 2 bits per pixel. And it made the pixels wider. So if you have any sort of like 4-color mode on those, you drop down to 160 horizontal pixels as well, which is also all the faster that NTSC can even change colors. So it didn't really matter.
Back then it was enough, you know, for games. So yeah, nobody was complaining at the time.
Yeah, joystick only had one button and we liked it.
That's right. We played games uphill in the snow both ways.
Yep.
So one of the things that really stands out about your projects is just the sort of level of polish on the manufacturing of them. So I'm looking at pictures of your 2GS laptop here, and you know, one of your earlier projects, the edges are all nice and clean and the materials are nice. So can you talk a little bit about your manufacturing process, what materials you use, what tools you use, that sort of thing?
Sure. At my shop, I have 3 major tools that I use. I have a CNC machine, which is used to mill materials. You can like put sheets of material on it and it will cut patterns and concavities. I also have a laser cutter, which is a, well, I guess it's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? And that's really good for making highly detailed things if you want to have a good resolution. Like laser cutter can cut with like 1200 dots per inch resolution. So if you want text that looks nice, you can put in material. You can actually use the laser to raster and cut the text and then also cut the material out. So it can, you know, it can score the surface of things and it can also cut through things. And I've always wanted to put a pizza in it, but I haven't. And my warranty expired a year ago, I want to say. So it's been a year now where I should have put a pizza into it. You know what? I need to clean that thing anyway. It's kind of dirty. I should cook the pizza or cut a pizza with it and then clean it.
Yeah, I think that needs to happen.
It's like microwaving a bowl of soup with the lid off before cleaning your microwave. It's like, well, who cares, right? Anyway, and then another tool that I use, I have a couple of 3D printers. And in the case of the Apple One replica, I think I made the keys with the 3D printer. Yes, I made the keys with the 3D printer and also the hinges. And I also had this jig where I would print the keys in white plastic, white ABS, 3D print them. Then I would spray paint them with black enamel. Then I stuck them in my laser and used the laser to etch the letters in them. So I was pretty proud of that process.
That actually is really cool.
Yeah. So the thing that I find is, you know, use the different machines for what they're best at. Like a CNC machine is good for making large volumes of precise pieces. So like the casing of the Apple replica was done using black Sintra, which is a high density PVC foam. Foam isn't really accurate. I mean, it's very dense compared to foam, but that's technically what it is. So the large machine can use its bits and like carve that out and make pieces that look nice. And unlike a 3D printer, where you have to build it up, you know, you can make large things quickly. Then the laser printer, or I'm sorry, laser. Well, I guess, yeah, it is a printer. It's basically a network printer, which is really cool. If you want to make like a nice wood inlay or make a nice wood plate or text, it's really good at cutting precise pieces of wood. You know, because a CNC machine, you're limited to the size of the bit. Whereas a laser, well, technically the laser has a width. It's like 0.00. It's like about 2/1000th of an inch, which sometimes you have to take into account, but not usually. So if you want to do really fine work, you can use the laser for that. And the nice thing about the laser is it's not physical. It's a laser. So you don't have to worry about pushing things around or moving things. You just literally set things in it and they get cut.
Oh, is that right?
Holds them in place. Yeah. Yeah. Cause this laser beam just comes down and cuts them.
Yeah, I suppose. I never thought about that, but yeah, that's neat.
Yeah. It's the same thing when they use a plasma cutter on like metal or a metal laser. The metal just sits there usually and it gets hit with a laser. So I find that using multiple different tools can achieve the best results. When I do, smaller projects, if I'm making, some sort of Raspberry Pi portable or something, I'll usually use the 3D printer to make a more complex volumetric case for it, you know, a little beyond what a CNC machine can do. But then I'll use the laser cutter to make like nice looking end caps, because 3D printers look good. You know, they can make good looking stuff, but they don't always make like a good front visible surface, but the laser's really good at that. So I like to use multiple tools and then combine them for a finished look. Yeah.
that's a good way to put it. So,
and lots of hot glue.
Yeah, lots of hot glue. So now some of those tools are recent acquisitions though, right? How did you get by without some of those fancier things? Like in, say, for the 2GS laptop, that was in 2008, right? So did you have all those same tools at the time, or did you?
No, I didn't, but I would just go elsewhere and have it done. So I would pay to have it done before I had my own equipment. But then I bought my own equipment, so now I can... Now I have a CNC machine and I can set things on it and use it as a table. You know, there's other things I still don't have. Like I don't have a metal laser, nor would I ever buy one because I don't think I could afford it.
Yeah.
But you know, it's if you know people that have one or companies that have one, you can subcontract it out. Although one thing that's kind of tricky is a lot of companies don't want to deal with you because if they can't make 1,000 of something, they don't care.
Right.
And that's an obstacle. I don't know if it's as bad as it used to be because, you know, you have things like Shapeoku or Shapeways and all these services that exist now. So it's not that hard to get into. Oh, and in hackerspaces, obviously, you know, they usually have tons of tools that you can use. So it's getting better. And, you know, 3D printers are all the rage and they are awesome. I have like three of them, but they can't do everything. So it's about picking the best tool for the job, which sounds like a really generic thing to say, but you know.
Yeah, that's very true. So I'm working on a project with my Apple IIc where I'm building kind of a lid for it. And so it's about, you know, 12 inches square and kind of a shell. And I tried to 3D print it with Shapeways and it actually, they said they couldn't print it. It was coming out warped, I guess, because of the large sort of surface that isn't very thick. They said
you said it was 12 inches in one dimension. That's a very large 3D print.
Yeah. It is. It's right at the limit of what Shapeways will print.
I'm actually surprised they would even try to print anything remotely that big, to be honest.
Yeah, they have certain materials and certain colors where they'll, I think their maximum volume is about 14 inches cubed, but
cubed?
Yeah, something like that. They could only print this in white and only in a couple of materials, but they gave it a college try and fortunately was too big for that. It was worth a try. So on the subject of, you mentioned 3D printing for hinges, I'm actually, this is, might be a little bit inside baseball, but I'm actually interested in your hinges. That's a kind of a difficult thing to make for a laptop, because of course it has to be easy to open, but then stay, you know, at any position you put it in. How do you make your hinges? Do you have a couple designs that you use, or?
The hinges I used on the replica were left over from Xbox 360 laptop I designed a couple years ago. And that was actually one of the first things I made when I got my MakerBot back in 2012. They're not necessarily a friction hinge. They basically, you just use a screw and you put them through, and then they open up to a certain distance and they stop. So they're not, well, actually they are pretty stiff, but they aren't like something like a laptop where you can open it, you know, whatever degree you want, and it'll stay in place.
I see.
But they do work pretty good. I can send you the 3D files if you'd like.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be fun. We can share them in our show notes. Yeah, I've been trying to buy friction hinges for this purpose, and it's tough to find ones that are weak enough. You know, when you buy friction hinges, they're presumably intended
for... Yeah, they're usually at least 8 pounds.
They're intended for like cabinet doors and stuff, things that are much heavier than a laptop lid. So there are some...
Things that involve a lot of leverage.
Exactly.
Literally.
Yeah. To open. Yeah, exactly.
Because if you try to undo a friction hinge by hand, you can't.
Yes.
I mean, you can maybe, yeah, because it requires a lever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you try to move them with just your thumbs, it seems like, yeah, it won't move. And there are some adjustable ones, actually, but they tend to be kind of bulky. So it's tough to find just the right thing for hinges.
Yes. I also designed my own chip clip, because that's kind of like a rite of passage with 3D printers.
Your own, I'm sorry, chip clip?
Chip clip. Yeah, you got to make a chip clip for the bag of chips.
Okay.
Crisps, if you're British.
Oh, right. The like a spring clip that you use to hold the bag closed. Okay.
I always thought that they're too difficult. It's like, oh my gosh, it takes like it takes thought to put on this chip clip. So I made kind of like this inverse spring thing. I mean, it doesn't use a metal spring. It's all plastic, but it's on Thingiverse if you want to check it out. I was dialing in a printer. I got a new printer and I was trying to dial it in. And so I was printing things over and over and over. And I'm like, well, if I'm going to be printing things over and over and over that don't have to be perfect, I think I would create a bunch of chip clips. So I designed one, and then I think I gave most of them to my friends, but I have one at here. Because the thing is, you don't have to squeeze it. You basically just stick it on. It's kind of hard to explain.
I think I got you. Yeah, because the rolled up plastic bag kind of expands and holds the clip in place. Is that the idea?
Yeah, kind of like that. But it seems to work pretty good. I use it.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I use binder clips for that, those black things with the little silver.
Oh, yeah. That seems like a pretty simple solution.
Those things are great. I use them for attaching and clamping things all over the house. Half my life is binder clips. Do you have any sort of changing gears a little bit now? Do you have any particular history with the Apple II? You mentioned that you used them to play games in high school. Anything else that comes to mind?
Well, I didn't just play games with them. Mostly school. I'm old enough that when I – well, I guess there's still Apples in schools, but everything was like an old Apple. As I mentioned, even in high school, we were using the 2Es in computer class.
Yeah.
I do remember when I was a senior, I took computer 2. I basically took computer classes just to increase my GPA. So I guess I used Apples for that. I remember this now. I would write the program in like 5 minutes or whatever, and then I would spend the rest of the period playing SimCity on the Macintosh. So that was pretty easy.
So Mike, I'm monopolizing the conversation here. You have any questions for Ben?
Oh, I had a comment first and then a question. And the comment is, there's this Monty Python skit called Pet Conversions, where John Cleese walks into a pet shop and he wants a cat, and Michael Palin offers him a terrier, and he says, no, I want a cat. And Palin says, well, I can, you know, I'll let its legs down, take its snout out, stick a few wires through its cheeks, and there you have a lovely cat. And it goes kind of back and forth. And so sort of when somebody has a 2GS sitting there and they look across the room and they see this laptop, and there's a certain psychology that goes, you know, I'm going to turn this into that. And that's always sort of fascinated me. We've talked a lot about the cases and how beautiful they are, and the attention to detail and polish that you put in your projects, and it's undeniably gorgeous. As far as though the electronics, obviously you're going to have to reconfigure boards and cut and
sometimes, yeah.
What's the process there? Do you have to like remanufacture pieces? Because when you cut into a PCB, you're going to be cutting traces and things like that. What goes on there?
I'm trying to remember how I did it with the Apple IIgs. I guess I don't remember exactly how I did it with that, but I will tell you what process I would use.
Sure.
You'd look at the motherboard, and then you realize what you absolutely need. If you're modifying something that runs off batteries or it runs off a modern screen, there might be portions of the PCB you don't even need, which means you can omit them completely. You can cut traces as long as you don't use what it's connected to. If you do cut traces or you have to bend it or circuit bend it, you can always rewire them. Another 8-bit computer that maybe is a on your hit list. What was the TRS-80 Model 100, that portable white computer from like 1983? Yeah. So anyway, I got one off eBay or whatever, and I was like, oh, yeah, this thing's awesome. But I had to go in, and there's some corrosion on the keyboard, so I had to go in. So even if there are broken traces, you can patch them up. You can add little wires or little snippets of solid wire and fix it. So that's not really a challenge. So if it's something that you try to make something that fits the size of it. So if you've got a 2GS motherboard, for instance, which is fairly large, I would say, and you're like, okay, well, this motherboard is kind of shaped like a screen, so I'm going to rotate it, sideways. Oh, now it's, wider than it is tall. So this gives me like a baseline. Oh, and my screen is, 12 inches. So yeah, that's about the same size as the motherboard. So yeah, this is kind of the size of what I'm going to build. The shape of what you have kind of dictates it. And I also like to use original hardware whenever possible. You could just recreate this stuff in FPGA, but it's fun to have kind of like the romanticism of using the original parts and, bringing them into the present. And that's why I like making the custom cases. It's kind of like, what would this look like if it had been built back then? Like, I did a Atari 800 laptop, and it's all beige and the color's really ugly, but it looks like it, belongs in the 70s.
Right. Yep.
So part of it, half the battle really, it's all about nostalgia. It's like, oh, this reminds me of that time. I have a feeling toward like, oh, this, it reminds me of my youth. It reminds me of how those things looked. Oh, look, it has these certain colors. It's dingy and beige. It has all these pointless vent holes that you didn't really need. It's all about like, bringing that back and honoring that the era, but also, putting a new spin on it. And of course, curved rounded corners. I mean, if you look at that stuff now, like you've like a Sega Genesis, there's all this like black ribbing and grooves on it. And like all it did was look cool and collect dust. It had no function. Maybe it made the case sturdier, but who cares? All the plastic was textured back then. That was insane. I can't replicate that, unfortunately.
Yeah, there was definitely an era of electronics there where everything had to have ridges and reliefs and things on the surface that was supposed to look high tech or something. But yeah, it was just maddening because it all collected dust.
Well, it was an industrial design trend. Yeah. I mean, you see that. Apple starts a lot of industrial design trends. They pretty much start all of them in computing. You go from one thing. Yeah, I remember like in the late 90s when everything was like neon colored, like, oh, it's a translucent neon colored whatever because of the iMac.
Yeah.
And then everything was white. And then I think, what are we on now? We're on everything's black, I believe. Black is the new black. Sure, it's industrial design. I kind of like the brushed aluminum thing that was kind of – that was hot right after neon and then before Apple White.
Yeah, I think we're still sort of there. Everything is kind of an aluminum slab now. And I think aluminum slab plus chamfered edges and black or white shiny plastic, I think, seems to be where we're at now.
Yeah, I have an Ultrabook that's a black aluminum brushed slab. So it's pretty much exactly what you're saying. Yes, exactly. I like designing in lighter colored materials because they're easy to see when I'm working on them and they photograph well. But sometimes, you have to make something. If something like says, oh, it has to be like glossy black, then I'll do it. But usually I like lighter colors.
Yeah.
I'm looking through the different projects that you've done here, and it looks like most of these are either one-time commissions or one-off things. So is this just mostly you're doing this because you can and it's a challenge and you're having a good time, or are you making enough money off of these one-time things that's how you're paying for all of this?
So it used to be that I would build things for customers. People like, hey, I really want a portable Commodore 64. I want a portable Xbox, blah, blah, blah. And I would, build the same thing over and over. Lately anymore, we spend quite a bit of time on the Ben Heck show. So if we do build something that's usually on the show, it's like, hey, 8-bit computers, let's try to replicate the Apple One. So we kind of build things for the show, if that makes sense. I still do projects for people, not as much as I used to, like individuals. I do a lot of things with accessibility. I'm making all these batches of accessibility controllers, people who don't have full facility of their hands to play modern games, which are really complicated. So I tend to do things more like that. It's one of those things, like, it's the irony, like, as you get older, you get busier, and you have more money to build this stuff, but you don't have the time or the machines. Like, I kind of wonder, like, 10 years ago, what I would do if I had the machines I have now. I'd probably be like, woohoo! But now it's like, oh, man, I don't have time to build all this stuff. And, like, the time it takes to make something custom, it eats up a lot of time to make one custom thing. Like, if you can't make 10 or 20 or 50 of something, it's really not worth the effort. But if we can do it, you know, on the show, kind of as a, you know, a demonstration or a basically as entertainment, then it's worth it. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So this Apple One project, then how many hours would you say you have invested in, you know, start to finish from thinking, hey, I could do this to putting it together on the show for people?
Oh, that one wasn't too bad. I don't know. Maybe like, 20 hours.
Oh, okay.
Maybe 25. No, it's a very simple, even though I wired it by hand, it's a very simple system. It's, 6502 RAM, ROM, addressing chips, some sort of video. Swish, done. This is kind of geeky, but I had a lot of fun, creating the ROM image for it. I really enjoyed that. Like the WAS monitor that fits in 256 bytes. First of all, I was like, oh my God, WAS is a god to do this. I was like, okay, I put this here. What would that be? FF00 through FFFF. And then, oh, if I want the basic, that would sit here in memory. And, I really had fun. What I did was, obviously you can't find a 256 byte ROM nowadays or EEPROM, but I had a 32 kilobyte EEPROM. So I'm like, okay, let's see. This would be at the second half of memory. And then we put all the RAM at the bottom. And if I'm not mistaken, I would think the original Apple had some RAM at the beginning and some RAM at the end because you could load basic into it. I can't picture the memory map off the top of my head, but it was kind of fun. Basically, like, going backwards from FFFF in the address space and figuring out where to put everything. Like, oh, I had to put the cassette adapter here. I have to leave a hole for the peripheral interface adapter because that was like at 6,000 hex. Yeah, that part I enjoyed. It was like kind of putting together a hex puzzle.
It's funny what you mentioned about the memory. It's almost hard to buy chips that small nowadays. I did my own retro computer design a while back, and I had that same thing where the smallest EEPROM I could find was 32K, and I only needed 4K of ROM. So there's literally 4K of code sitting at the top of this 32K ROM. When, of course, back at the time, people would have killed for that much ROM.
Yeah, they would have killed for 32K of RAM too.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is also about the, but you know, you can still buy it. You know, you can still buy parallel RAM and EEPROMs, and yeah, it's fun.
So that's sort of related to what Mike was asking about. So of course, I'm a big fan of the Ben Heck show, but of course, in that sort of 20-minute format, it's hard to get into a lot of detail. So do you have a place on your website somewhere where people can look at the schematics and, you know, the hex files and so on and see some of the gorier details?
So we take our project files and we put them on the Element 14 community.
Okay.
Because the main goal of the show is to drive the community and the website. So that's where we put our files.
Okay.
For instance, we just did one on FPGA, and the editor, Allison, she's like, oh my gosh, we could have made like 2 episodes out of this. So she's like, I'm going to condense this and this and this. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Because like filming me typing code into a computer it's like all these Hollywood movies where they have these scenes involving hackers and computers. Like, this is not interesting.
Yeah.
So what we do is, like, instead of like showing me type everything into the computer, we make that very brief, and then we just make the code available online because that's all people want anyway.
Right. So cool. Yeah.
That's kind of how we handle that. But yeah, we usually make all the files available. So I don't care.
Cool. Yeah, we'll definitely link to that in the show notes. Yeah, it's funny. These projects, the end result is cool, but 95% of the process of building it is not good television.
It's like an iceberg. Yeah. you film about 10%, and the other 90% is like the cursing and swearing and kicking things. Well, it's not that bad, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The what's that, like 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration?
That's right. Yeah.
That's definitely one of the best axioms of all time. So yeah, we can't film everything because we'd have so much footage. It would be impossible to edit through in a week, and it would be pointless because, you know, we'll have like, okay, here's how I wire this. Now I have to do it 20 more times off camera. That's usually what happens. Oh, well.
Cool. So I don't think our audience would forgive me if I didn't ask, but the 2GS laptop is a bit of a holy grail for a lot of people, especially regular attendees of Kansas Fest, the annual Apple II conference. And it says, and of course, on your website that you won't be building any more of them, but is there any chance of ever building any more of those?
Well, sure. If someone gave me enough money, I'd do it. I guess, like I mentioned, I have another Apple 2GS motherboard laying around my shop and an extra RAM expansion. So, yeah, maybe someday I could build one. You know, I tend to be working on other things. My workflow is not quite what it used to be. It's not, well, that sounds like I'm lazy. It's not the same. I mean, I'm always working. I mean, as soon as I get done with this, I'm going to go right back to working on my SD card routines. But, yeah, maybe someday.
I want to see an Apple III laptop.
Oh, keep your Apple III nonsense out of this podcast, Mike.
Was Apple III and Lisa two different things?
Yes. Okay. The Apple III came out in 1980, and it was sort of the – at first it was going to replace the Apple II line, and then it became the stopgap until they could get Lisa out the door. The Apple III is more of an extension of Apple II technology, sort of a superset. The Lisa was the, let's make this GUI. We'll put the Motorola chip in there. And then Macintosh was the effort to make that smaller and more affordable.
Oh, okay. Now I know.
So I was saying how the 2GS is a bit of an odd duck. Well, the Apple III makes the Apple 2GS look like the IBM PC.
Well, the Apple I've seen many Apple 2GSs. I don't think I might have seen an Apple II or Apple III once. Heck, I think I've seen Apple Pippin more than I've seen an Apple III.
And it's the oddest of odd duck computers. But
I have a friend who bought a Newton PDA, like not back in the day, but like, you know, decades later off eBay. It was kind of cool.
Yeah, I actually at the time bought a Newton PDA. I was in university at the time, and I spent far too much money that I did not have on that thing because I was very excited about it. And it was probably one of the worst things I ever bought.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I you could definitely appreciate what they tried to do. But yeah, the technology was definitely not there. You know, it needed to be the iPhone, and it was 10 years too soon for it, or 15 years, I guess, too soon for it.
You should have got a trash 80 model 100. You can still talk RS-232. It's amazing.
Yeah, that thing has a real cult following as well. I know that one of our retro computing luminaries, Earl Evans, is a big fan of that. And it's actually still quite popular, that thing. It was a great little machine.
Yeah, I'm glad that I bought one. And I guess they started going up in price because it was on that Halt and Catch Fire TV show.
Yeah, we practically have a Halt and Catch Fire segment on this show. They always talking about tangentially related topics, and we like to pick apart the historical accuracies and inaccuracies, like the nerds that we are.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever seen it. I know that sounds sacrilegious. It's good?
I wouldn't say you're missing a lot. We like to talk about it just because of the subject matter, but as a dramatic show, I wouldn't say it has a whole lot going for it. I don't honestly know if it's even going to come back for season two.
It's better as computer history than actually as scripted drama.
Yeah, I would say it's fun as kind of a nostalgic time machine. It's fun to see the 80s computers in the background and the 80s clothes and cars and so on. But I wouldn't say it's necessarily succeeding as scripted drama, no.
Oh, so it basically rides on its nostalgia?
So far, yeah. This is all just my opinion of it, but I haven't been very impressed with the actual...
Oh, in that case, I probably wouldn't be very impressed with
it. Yeah, it's become sort of an exercise in... try to spot your favorite vintage computer on the show.
Oh.
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, you know, I kind of thought the same thing. Like, all my friends who are married and have kids are like, oh, you got to see Wreck-It Ralph. It's got all this video game stuff in it. I'm like, oh, God, it's just going to be a bunch of references to video games that I perfectly – I remember quite well. I don't need a movie to remember them for me. But then when I watched it, it had some of that, but, you know, I was pleasantly surprised. Well, maybe I'll, if I'm really, really bored, maybe I'll watch Halt and Catch Fire. But I have like 50,000 other Netflix shows I'm supposed to get through first, according to people.
Some of that retro stuff does genuinely turn out to be good. Yeah, Wreck-It Ralph and the other one. What's the other one with something or other, the dude that saves the world?
Oh, Scott Pilgrim
versus the World? Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Thank you. Yeah, those two movies are actually quite good as movies, in addition to the shameless plugs of video game.
He wasn't saving the world. He was versus the world.
Right. Yes. Thank you.
Oh, but what about the Adam Sandler movie that's coming out this year, Pixels?
Oh, I haven't heard about that one.
Have you heard about that?
No.
It's, I think it's basically a ripoff of a Futurama episode. Futurama is like the modern Twilight Zone for like getting ideas from. It's like aliens intercept broadcasts from Earth of like Donkey Kong and Space Invaders, and they think they're war tapes, so they attack Earth using like things that look like old video games. Oh, it's going to be total nostalgic trash.
Okay.
Sounds like Galaxy Quest.
Yes, except for Galaxy Quest was an amazing film.
That's true.
Now, Galaxy Quest is secretly one of the best Star Trek movies.
Absolutely.
Just like Star Fox is one of the best Star Wars games. No, correction. It is the best Star Wars game. Now we're really off topic. Was there anything else you wanted to cover?
Where can people find you on the web and in the internet spaces and things like that?
On the intertubes. Okay. You can go to www.element14.com/TBHS. That's the Ben Heck Show. You can also find it on YouTube. I also have my own personal YouTube channel, which I rarely update, which is benheck.com, I think, spelled out. It's very strange. It's always annoying when I go to websites and Ben Heck is already taken. Although last night I was at opencores.org and I tried to log in. I'm like, what bleep hole took Ben Heck? And then I'm like, oh, wait, it was me. I just forgot my password. Steam, though. Someone on Steam has Ben Heck. That I had to be Ben underscore Heck. Anyway, back to topic. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at benheck.com, all one word. And, of course, my website, www.benheck.com.
Awesome. Well, we will link to all of that in the show notes.
Super.
Thanks for joining us today, Ben.
Yeah, we really appreciate having you on the show. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been fun taking a trip down memory lane.
All right. Well, that was a great interview. Thank you, Quinn, for handling a lot of the tough technical stuff. When we were preparing for that, I wasn't really sure what I was going to ask him because I don't know enough about things like industrial design, and especially when you're kind of re-engineering somebody else's industrial design, and then to feel like I could ask intelligent questions. And so I appreciate you stepping in and covering all that.
Oh, not at all. I had the opposite problem, honestly. If you could have spared enough time, I would have made it a 5-hour interview just because as a fellow hacker, builder, maker type person, I'm a big fan of his, and there was tons and tons of stuff I would have loved to have asked him. But alas, he's a busy chap, so we had to stay focused on Apple II.
Fame and celebrities and all that.
So, let's talk about some news, Mike.
Sounds good to me.
Get what's new and exciting in retro computing with 2 News.
All right, so I'm looking at our handy dandy spreadsheet here, and it looks like you have the first item, Quinn.
I do.
Tell me about Bill Budge.
Yeah, I love talking about Bill Budge. Of course, he's a legend in the community. I don't think he needs any introduction. One of his more famous products was Pinball Construction Set. And now Bill Budge was, I guess what nowadays we would call a tools programmer more than a game programmer. At the time, that distinction wasn't really clear yet, but there's sort of two kinds of game programmers. There's people that build games, and there's people that build tools for other people to build games. And there's a definite division there. You either, you're sort of passionate about one or the other. Most people are passionate about engines and tools or passionate about building games. So I think Bill maybe falls into the tools side of things, because he used to talk a lot about in interviews about how he liked to build things that enabled people to build their own types of games. So Pinball Construction Set was one of his first major forays into that type of thing. He used to talk about, I remember in an interview, he had talked famously that his holy grail was a construction set. He wanted to to try and build the ultimate tool set that would let you build other tools. And that was actually a visionary idea in the 1980s. I think nowadays that has basically been achieved with, things like Unity and so on, these sort of very general game engines that we have now. But in any case, the point of all this is that the Pinball Construction Set source code has now been released. Now, before you get too excited, it is the Atari version, Blue Atari. But what's interesting about it is, now, as far as I know, the Apple II source has not been released, but it may also be out there. So forgive me if I'm wrong about that. But what's interesting about the Atari version, Blue Atari, is that the Apple II is actually used in the build process. So there's some scripts that actually use the Apple II ROM monitor as part of the building of it. I guess, you know, he probably used whatever he was comfortable with, and being, you know, originally an Apple II programmer, when it came time to port it to the Atari, he probably just, you know, kind of built on what he had for tools. But yeah, it's neat to see. So we will definitely link to that in the show notes.
You know, I have memories, vague, haunting memories, I guess, of reading about a lot of developers, and I guess maybe there was some real similarities between the Atari and the Apple II on that level when you're designing, because it seemed to be a common thing, not prevalent, but certainly a noticeable minority of Apple II developers would develop on the Atari and then compile it over the Apple II because it was an easy translation. I'm not sure. You had to obviously redo the graphics to fit Woz's wonky designs for that. But so that seemed to be a standard thing to do. That doesn't actually surprise me that much.
I think that sort of thing, that kind of mixing and matching, is probably a lot more common than we realize now. I think because those 80s computers were all really strong in different areas, I think that was probably pretty common to use them for different things. So, you know, the Apple II, of course, had the best, you know, 80 column text and the best disk drives and various other things like that. But then, of course, other machines had much better art tools because they had better graphics. So, you know, people would build the art on one machine and, you know, use another machine for compiling, or another machine for, you know, writing documentation or what have you. So I think this thing was probably more common than we realized at the time. So it's neat to kind of get a little bit of a window into that. Yeah, and we have to remember how interesting it is that they even did the development on these machines. You know, at the time, these were, you know, microcomputers. These were small systems. These are what we would today consider a microcontroller, for example. And so if you were quote unquote smart and or well-funded, you know, you would do something like what Infocom did, where they had a, you know, DEC mini computer that they developed on, and they just cross-compiled for these small computers because these small computers didn't have enough, you know, memory and disk and so on to compile and run code on the machine and also, you know, test on the machine. So, you know, that would be equivalent to nowadays either, you know, writing code on a microcontroller for a microcontroller, which, you know, would be silly. Of course, you use your laptop to do the actual development. Or on a modern game system, it would be like plugging a keyboard into your Xbox and then running a compiler on your Xbox to develop, you know, an Xbox game, which again is silly. You would never do that. So the fact that people in those days did in fact do that says a lot about how small these operations were and how expensive, I guess, this equipment was for them to buy. So pretty neat.
Now, stand by for a smooth segue coming up your way. Quinn, you have something about a particular microcontroller board that you can buy right now that would be of interest to our Apple II users. Whew, I need to wipe the sweat off.
Wow. Yeah. I'm
good.
I'm glad I moved to the edge of my seat for that one, because that was almost an actual genuine segue.
I know, right?
Well done.
I'm talented.
It's a shame we called all this attention to it, though, and ruined it.
Oh.
So I do, in fact, have some news on a subject that everybody's been waiting for and I've been getting asked a lot about, and that's the Western Design Center's 6502-based hobby development boards. They have various names. I think they go by the name Accelerator with an X, and they are also known as the 65XX boards and the SXB boards. They have various names, but they've been in development for seemingly forever, and I showed an early prototype at Kansas Fest in 2014, and they are now finally available for sale. Sort of. Sort of, unfortunately. So they are available now on Mouser. I think Jameco might also be listing them, but I'll link to Mouser because that's what I could find. And they are not showing as in stock yet, but they can at least be ordered. So that's genuine progress. What's still unknown is exactly what the tools look like. Last time I looked at them, the prototype tools were sort of some, I have to say, a little bit clunky command line tools for Windows only, you know, not like the kind of nice GUI tools that you would come to expect with an Arduino or something like that. So I haven't seen the final product, so I'm not going to pass judgment until I do, but you can at least put in a credit card number somewhere and and something may happen and you may get a board at some point. So that's progress.
In software news, CiderPress, the Windows disk image management tool that is completely awesome and we wish we had on Mac, but fortunately we sort of do because it runs under Wine, has been ported to, or has been updated to version 4.0.0 D1. CiderPress has been out for, obviously, I think it's been for, almost 10 years or more now. And as Windows XP and these other technologies are sort of fading into the past and newer stuff's coming around, I think there were some problems with CiderPress with Windows 7 and things like that. And Andy McFadden, the author, decided it was time to give it a refresh, and he's released 4.0.0 D1, and he says this is a development release. Version 3.0.1 is still the official stable release. From a user perspective, it's feature equivalent to version 3.0.1, but if you are interested, you can go to his website, a2ciderpress.com, and download it and play with it.
Yeah, as a Mac user, I'm very jealous of CiderPress. It's ironic that the best tool for working with Apple II disk images is only available on Windows.
Yeah, it's sort of unfortunate, but if you're willing to mess around with Wineskin and programs like that, you can get it running, I think, without too much problem. I have it on my running on Yosemite on this iMac that I have in front of me right now, and it wasn't very difficult to set up at all.
Okay, yeah, I have Parallels, actually, so I should give it a try under that. I'm a big fan of Parallels. Yeah, honestly, I guess I've got a set of command line commands set up using Apple Commander, the Java tool, and it works well enough for basic stuff, but definitely wish I had CiderPress for Reels.
It certainly makes it a lot easier to deal with that, because you can load up your image and see what's on the disk and mess around with it. It's good stuff. You should check it out for sure if you don't have it already. Have you received Chris Torrance's new book yet, Quinn?
I did, yes. There was some there was some possible drama there. He sent Mike and I a copy of the book, and yes, thank you so much, Chris. And I was afraid he had sent it to my home address. The neighborhood I live in, there things have a tendency to get stolen off the doorstep when the UPS guy leaves them on the step, which they always do if you're not home, it seems. And it had been a while, and I haven't received it, and I was getting worried. And then Chris let me know that he'd sent it to my office, actually. So when I went into the office the other day to pick up some things while on holiday, it was there waiting for me. So I have it in my hand right now, and it is beautiful, I have to say.
It is now. He sent us. Did he send you the hardcover version?
He did. Yeah. It sounds like this.
I don't have the website up in front of me right now, but I'm hoping when I use a book like this, it's Roger Wagner's Assembly Lines. You know, it's guides and tutorials and code to help you learn assembly language programming. And when I'm using a book like that to learn, I like to have the Apple in front of me and this thing open next to me so I can reference it while I'm working. And it's sort of difficult to do with a hardback book. I'm hoping that it will be released. If you can get that as a soft cover, that'd be great. And having it on my iPad as an ebook would be even better, to just flip back and forth and have it searchable. So fingers crossed for that.
Yeah, I really like having reference books on my iPad for the searching and bookmarking abilities. Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I think my use of this book will actually mostly be as just an interesting, nostalgic kind of read and maybe learn a few tips and tricks about the Apple II. But I am interested in hearing the perspective of someone who is genuinely going to use it to learn assembly language. Because, yeah, judging by this John Romero quote on the back cover here, it's apparently very good for that. So let me see if I can quote here. It says, "I am not exaggerating when I say I merely read the first few pages in chapter one, and all of a sudden, assembly language totally made sense to me. Very few times in my life have I had such an important event happen to me in a lightning bolt-like form as when I read the first chapter and understood without error exactly how it works." So that's high praise indeed from John Romero. So I'm wondering if you might also have that same lightning bolt-like experience.
I wonder if that's from John Romero of old.
Well,
because I would assume that John Romero of 2014 knows very well Apple assembly language and wouldn't have grabbed his copy of Chris's release and just suddenly had this revelation when he's had 30 years to
learn. Yes, I assume that is a vintage quote, possibly from the original edition of the book. I'm not sure. it is honestly, it looks like really a great book for learning. I didn't actually expect that. I thought it was just, you know, I knew it was a collection of the original articles from SoftTalk. So I guess I assumed it would be kind of a mishmash of, you know, pro tips and hidden sneaky tricks and things like that, not necessarily like a read it front to back tutorial on programming the Apple II. But it seems like it actually is kind of that. And just flipping through it, it looks like it is quite good for that. So especially in some of the technical areas that are unique to the Apple II, like, you know, high-res graphics and so on, which can be some of the more challenging areas to learn. You know, you can learn 6502 assembly from 1,000 different sources, and, you know, it's really not that hard. But then once you try to make the Apple II do something, now you have to learn the gnarly memory map and all the other weird tricks and the artifact color and so on. So it does seem to have a lot of that. Unfortunately, of course, the original articles kind of end at the very early part of the Apple IIe, so there's nothing about double high-res graphics or some of the later topics, but still, for what it is, it's pretty remarkable.
Roger Wagner, you'll see that he's got a great way of communicating this information in a no-nonsense way that makes sense pretty much without a whole lot of work. It is assembly language, so there are some math hurdles there and things that you might have to overcome if you're learning assembly language for the first time, but it never feels like it's impossible. And I think one of the big things that he understood that maybe some of these other early authors didn't was that you're more likely to stick to this and actually learn the thing if you're working